Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update, and this week joins us for the weekly update from the Holy City of Jerusalem. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you, and especially from sunny, warm, beautiful Yerushalayim. Yesterday, I think Tel Aviv, it was 70 or certainly like 60, high 60s. And here in Yerushalayim today, it's really beautiful.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So I don't want to rub it in, but you did say 2, right? Wind chill factor is 2 degrees.
So you're suggesting
if anybody needs a reason for Aliyah, you just got it.
So you're suggesting that if I was in Jerusalem, I likely would not be suffering with this sore throat and all the assorted stuff.
You wouldn't be suffering at all.
My gosh. Why didn't I think of taking a trip? How come Malcolm always thinks of the good ideas, I wonder? There's so much.
And work 24 hours around the clock here.
That's right. But in that weather, who minds? Are you feeling the election atmosphere? Are you feeling the heightened sense of circus-like conditions that usually accompany the weeks before an Israeli election?
Yes and no. Yes, there is the hype, and now it's played out in the cute and funny or not so funny ads that people are taking out. But I feel a much more greater sense of resignation, uncertainty. People, aside from those who have a hard commitment to a particular party, which is not many, for left and right, that there's a lot of vacillation. I don't think anybody's excited about this election in the sense that they feel that there will be a massive change coming. I think a lot of people would welcome the fact that there will be stability. So right now, the latest polls, I think, show the Likud, one could say, surging in a way ahead. I think they're 4 seats now ahead of Labor when about a week or two ago they were behind. Then they evened up, and now, according to the polls I saw this morning, they are ahead. So it's and the votes come from different parties, and they go up and down a couple votes, and they will do so for the next month.
You know, I had this discussion with Mayor Weingarten during our Tu B'Shvat special. Do you agree or disagree that some of these commercial spots would never be done by major candidates in the United States? I know there's a lot of outrageous behavior before elections, especially with the talk shows, etc. They go on, do certain things. But I don't know. I'm not as into these television ads that I keep watching from Israel like some other people are.
I am not either. I don't know. I mean, Israelis have reacted to them. To my surprise, people who I respect were reacting to them much more strongly. But as entertainment, I don't know if they make the political link, and that may be the clever part, is that you want the message to be subliminal. So, you know, that I don't know how people in the end react. You know, there's the babysitter ad and some of the others that
you know how you say babysitter in Hebrew, Malcolm?
The campaigns here can get pretty vicious. This one is. You have a lot of charges, accusations. There's pending charges against Mrs. Netanyahu and Mr. Netanyahu, and they're charged against so many others. You know, it gets very dirty, down and dirty in these elections.
Is there a kingmaker emerging? Is there anybody from a minor party or somebody from the religious parties that people are looking toward as major candidates, you know, that they must have them on their side at this point, or that doesn't exist yet in this campaign?
I don't think it exists at all. I don't think that there's anybody who rallies people to you know, great excitement. You had new parties, Kahalon, and you see how quickly the enthusiasm dissipates. People don't like who they select for the tickets. People don't like or don't feel that they're strong enough in their positioning. I don't see anyone that fits the description you're saying. You know, they've had Netanyahu for a long time, so there's always a fatigue when you have somebody who serves for already 2 terms and served before. But, you know, the average Israeli government only lasts 2.5 years. So so they don't even have time to get tired of them.
And do you think this whole issue of a relationship with the White House, a relationship with the leader of the free world, is going to be a major issue in this campaign? Is it becoming one yet at this point, as the tension between Obama and Bibi seems to continue to escalate?
And it's far from over, and we can talk about that, but I think it is not as big a factor here because President Obama's popularity in Israel is pretty low. You don't have the backlash. There is concern. People are thoughtful, are concerned about what does this mean, and I'm asked all the time, you know, how will this affect it? And, you know, when members of Congress are coming out with the kind of statements they are, you know, that people are concerned. People who know this, the issues in the relationship are concerned.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that the average man in the street is concerned.
You know, you were asked about this whole topic on Israeli television this week. And, you know, in the old days, you knew that Israeli television essentially was only being watched by Israelis. Obviously, today we're in a much different era. Do you think you handled it differently today than you might have 15, 20 years ago, knowing that you're really speaking to the whole world now when you're addressing questions on Israel TV?
I honestly don't even think about it. I answer based on what I wanted to say, not necessarily even what they asked. And my message was that we have to get beyond this pettiness, and we have to, the people here also have to think about the consequences of, you know, the charges, the counter charges, the attacks, because, you know, the election will be over one way or another in a month, but you can have a residual impact. And it's true in terms of U.S.-Israel relationship, and I said that it's not dependent upon, you know, one incident like this. This hurts. There is a lot of bad feelings, I think, now on all sides, and I hope that there can be a resolution that will be an amicable one that both sides can live with. I think they're all looking at that now. Nobody wants to see this continued tension. I mean, there are people who will exploit it for political purposes here or there. We've had members of Congress making statements about not attending or, you know, sitting on their hands when they go.
Yeah.
So, that again, I think that will go through various changes. I think sometimes people are pressured into those kind of comments. Others are pressured into other comments. So my answers on the television, and everybody who would ask me, is I can't say what the prime minister is going to do, and I can't say what the president is going to do. What I do know is that we have to get past this. We are facing an enemy who poses an existential danger to both countries, and they are sitting there lapping this up. But I can tell you that in Arab countries, and I spoke to some key people from Arab countries in the last couple of days and before I came here, and they're very concerned about it. Because for them, the United Front is really critical weeks before the deadline for the negotiations, when we are facing serious charges and when challenges vis-a-vis Iran. When we need a United Front, I don't want to see this undermine the support that we have seen in Congress and House and Senate, that this be politicized, that Israel become a partisan issue. These would all be terrible developments. And so my answers were geared towards that.
Yeah, understood. Malcolm Honlein is live in Jerusalem as the weekly update continues here at JM in the AM. So a lot of things happened this week. You know, finally, Jordan was the country to start speaking ISIS's language. And I hate to put it that way, but sometimes that's the best way to put it. ISIS went ahead, and you know what happened. A very high professional video taken of one of the most brutal murders we've seen in recent years. Something, frankly, that our people could relate to in a way, but just so brutal and hard to believe. And that video has been shown and is available in many different media sources in its entirety. Some, of course, banned it or altered it, but it made changes so that the entire thing wouldn't be seen. But in many cases, you could see the entire thing. Jordan went ahead in response to the murder of this Jordanian pilot by ISIS and executed two prisoners. Did anybody of any significance come out against what Jordan did, or essentially the free world is completely understanding that this was their reaction?
I think the latter is true, but it wasn't just the executions, which took place almost immediately afterwards, and one of them was the prisoner, the attempted suicide bomber, who was captured by Jordan. It's been held there for a long time, and was requested by ISIS as part of a trade.
Right.
The Jordanians, I think, knew that that the pilot Sassabeh had already been killed, and I think they were kept pressing them and negotiated in good faith, but said, "Show us that he's alive. Let us see. We're ready to negotiate, but you got to give us proof." And I think King Abdullah showed the world, including America and including Europe, how you have to deal with it. He didn't just kill these two people who were facing death sentences. He went out and he bombed ISIS locations.
Right.
His jets were in the air, and he didn't apologize, and he didn't ask permission. He did what he had to do to send the message that Jordan wouldn't capitulate. And for Jordan, this is very critical because they have very delicate balances within the country.
Mm-hmm.
So the I think that the action and the question is, we still don't know how this is all going to play in Jordan, because the tribe from which this pilot came, which is a very large one and significant people, we saw demonstrations in the streets of their villages and towns, not against the United States, not against Israel, but against ISIS. However, the brutality that you described of this immolation, this horrific act, may move a lot of people to say, get out. We see it in Iraq. We see it in other places. We're ready that reaction. They're going to urge Jordan not to participate. Obviously, the king right now is not going to do that. And you could see the crowds in Raqqa, which I discussed before in Syria, the place where ISIS controls, and where they have training camps for foreign terrorists. There were cheering crowds in the streets as they broadcast that video, the execution scene, in the streets, in large screens. So you see how perverse the ISIS society is. The members, they can't say that they're not followers or they're not associated with it. They didn't carry out the act. They're supporting it.
Which leads to my next question. You may have just answered it, frankly. I talk about Jordan, you know, finally speaking ISIS's language. Does ISIS care? They go ahead, they commit this murder and other beheadings this week, as we know, since the last time we spoke. Do they care? Do they care that anybody that they had semi-concern about are, in fact, you know, executed publicly?
They do not. They not only not care, they welcome not the bombing, but the reaction. They want it to be horrific. What group would think that beheadings and this kind of, I mean, it's hard even, I couldn't watch it, the burning of this guy alive, would be something that they would want to publicize, at least try to hide your crimes, your shame. They advertise it because it's become a great recruiting tool.
Right. No, that
I see how people respond to it, and they don't care. The more criticism,
right,
the best.
That I,
they want to rally.
That I understand. Do they care that those two are then being executed because of their actions in murdering the Jordanian pilot? Do they, you know,
they don't care about human life. They don't value any of these.
Right. So,
they killed so many of their own.
So then is there
were three Chinese guys this week killed, ISIS members, because they tried to leave for home.
Right. So the question is, what's the value then of Jordan going ahead and executing them?
Because it shows the world that he's going to stand up to it. It says to the people who might affiliate and who might support both in Jordan, because you have ISIS in Jordan, just as you saw they caught ISIS members in the West Bank. ISIS continues to grow. That since they started the executions, they had more than 4,000 new recruits, and they're getting recruits from North Africa, 3,000 from Tunisia, 2,000 from Morocco, and then thousands from Europe, which is a new population. But they killed people all over. 48 executions in Iraq, 50 in Syria, just in the month of January.
Yeah.
It shows you their attitude, and that this intimidation silences any potential opposition, right?
Yeah.
They don't care what the West thinks of them.
Right.
Because they're sending a message so that when they face an opposition, when they march into a village, everybody runs because they say these brutal guys are going to cut off our heads.
So for those of us who are hoping that the Jordan executions would lead ISIS leaders to say, okay, guys, you know, hang on a minute, now we have somebody who's ready to stand up to us, it doesn't matter. That was not their reaction. They couldn't care less.
I wouldn't say in all aspects it doesn't matter, because one of them, that woman had some connection to leaders of ISIS, and when they kill people who are in the leadership or, you know, close family relatives, it of course it matters to some of the leadership, but to the ideology of ISIS as it has emerged welcomes this and is never going to be deterred by the executions. But there are other audiences that have to see it. You know, the Russians, when Hezbollah started killing their people in Lebanon at the time, you know, they caught some of the Hezbollah guys and sent parts of their anatomy back home.
Right.
All of a sudden, the kidnapping of Russians stopped.
Right.
Because the only language they understand is a language of force. And this is very regrettable. But all over the Middle East today, we are seeing the growth of Iranian influence, and that brings with it this extremism. They utilize these groups, whether it's Hezbollah or Hamas, which engage also in beheadings and which also engage in brutal, inhumane acts. You know, they don't necessarily make a video of every killing. But you remember in Gaza where that picture, the scene of 19 guys that they accused of being collaborators, and they
yep.
shot them in the back of the head?
Yep.
Why is that any better?
Yeah, it's all the same thing. Very hard to deal with an enemy that has no value for life.
Absolutely right.
Makes it
absolutely right. And it's an asymmetric war in many respects. They kill without any restrictions, and yet it's America that's held to account, let alone Israel, that's brought before the ICC, and the head of the Shabbos report, Professor Shabbos, has resigned, but they're going ahead with it. They appointed somebody in his place. The ICC goes ahead with its process, and yet the real murderers, the people who are violating human rights, the Hamas, Hezbollah, Iranians, others, just walk.
Malcolm, Homelines in Jerusalem. This is America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard and listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, broadcasting live from the Sonia and Robert Gold Studios in Jersey City, New Jersey, around the world on the web, jmtheam.org. Special welcome to those tuned in on the NSN app. You can comment on that app and toss in a comment whenever you wish. Yeah, I apologize for reading, but just give me a chance to go through these couple of paragraphs, because if there's one item that it seems our listeners are demanding for you to analyze for us this week, it's this one. At the National Prayer Breakfast, President Obama reminded attendees that violence rooted in religion is not exclusive to Islam, but has been carried out by Christians as well. Obama said that even though religion is a source of good around the world, there'll always be people willing to, quote, hijack religion for their own murderous ends. Quote, unless we get on our high horse and think this is unique to some other place, remember that during the Crusades and the Inquisition, people committed terrible deeds in the name of Christ. In our home country, slavery and Jim Crow all too often was justified in the name of Christ. Obama also denounced Islamic State terrorists for professing to stand up for Islam when they were actually, quote-unquote, betraying it. Quote, we see ISIL, a brutal, vicious death cult that in the name of religion carries out unspeakable acts of barbarism. He said, criticizing them for claiming the mantle of religious authority for such action. Seems a lot of people were outraged by the comparison to the Crusades in terms of ISIL in today's modern era. What's your reaction to President Obama's statement?
Well, I understand the outrage and why people feel that today, when Christians are being killed in the thousands, maybe tens of thousands, by Muslims, and the unwillingness generally of the administration, of European governments and others, to name those responsible, to isolate those who are responsible, because it's not every Muslim, and Muslims are often the first victims of the Islamist terrorist groups, but a community that refuses to denounce it, and if leaders refuse to name the name and shame them and isolate them and eliminate them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't say who it is and who's doing it, and to draw analogies, it is true clearly that people have died in the name of religion in many places, and that it still continues today. But you don't have terrorist organizations going around in Nigeria or in other places executing children. I just saw a report that the Human Rights, the Rights of Children Committee of the United Nations, they talk about cases of mass executions, crucifixions, and beheading of children in Iraq and burying them alive. What other group is doing this today? There are crazy people of every religion. There are, but this is organized. You don't have the kind of infrastructure that you have today under the name and the guise of radical Islamist. And we don't say Islam, we say Islamist to make the distinction, but to understand that Muslims have to denounce it, that the religious leadership have to be held to account and say where they stand, and to somehow try to, you know, minimize it or denigrate the unique nature of the danger, I think it's to hurt the effort to confront it. There is a lack of willingness. Why do we not hear the kind of condemnation that so readily we hear about Israel, let alone others, of Azerbaijan, of President Sisi? Look at all the criticism, but not Erdogan, a fundamentalist who's put all the journalists in jail, the generals in jail, eliminated rights, and yet you don't hear the condemnation of him, and he remains in NATO. I mean, it's incredible. And the fact that we're still negotiating, and this weekend there will be another round of negotiations with Iran. We hear reports of proposed deals, which certainly do not meet what was expected. They continue their ballistic missile development, the centrifuges, and undermining regime after regime. You know, the Khamenei said that Sunnis and Shiites control for the first time in history four Arab capitals, but they're active in many other Arab capitals, many African capitals, many South American, and globally. This is not, you know, a regime where we can sit down and have tea and say, well, like we did with Havana, we can do it with Tehran. No. And the idea that somehow if we reach a deal, even if it's not what we would call, what they would call a good deal, that you will buy peace or some kind of cooperation and minimization of violence in Syria and Iraq and other places, what you're going to buy is a century of conflict. You're going to see a nuclear arms race if it's not a deal. And every one country in the region is preparing for it. They're scared. And you know, leaks come from the Europeans about 6,500 centrifuges, other kinds of things. We're told that it's not true and that they're not close to it. And they're talking about a breakout time of 6 months, of 2 months. The stockpiling of enriched uranium at 5% is enough to produce four nuclear weapons. So we're at a very critical stage, and we have to be willing to isolate those who engage in these horrific acts, to cut them off, cut off those who support and abet them, and not obfuscate it.
And the reality is that every country, you could list every Middle Eastern country, they're all on that list of those who fear Iran, right? Even those who...
Everyone, including Lebanon, including the Syrians.
My point, you know, exactly, including those perceived to be their allies.
Because it's only partial. It's those who benefit and whose interests. Look how Sisi has stood up to the... to the challenges. When you mentioned King Abdullah, well, he has to at least crack down against them in the Sinai. Some people are critical, you know, that he's destroying houses along the border, but his people are dying otherwise. And they found the tunnels, more tunnels now, longer tunnels, 2,000 meter tunnels from the Sinai into Egypt, Gaza into Egypt. He's addressing it. And he's trying to take the steps that are necessary. Nobody says there aren't violations of human rights and tries to ignore the realities, but you got to look at the context in each country in which these things are happening.
You know, Caroline...
It's rebuilding its forces, weapons, advanced and more advanced weapons. They're not putting the cement to the building of the houses.
Right.
So they criticize Israel that there isn't reconstruction, but Israel sends in 600 trucks a day, and it goes into building again the military infrastructure.
Yeah, and this is an old story. People shouldn't be taken by surprise. You've been talking about this for years already. But Caroline Glick echoes what you've been telling us about Israel's relationship with Egypt. I mean, to the extent where she may actually believe at this point that Egypt's more of an important ally for Israel than the United States is. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
The United States remains, you know, a great power. Look at all the things that we do with them, the weapons, exchange, intelligence, military. At the United Nations, Egypt does not stand with us. The United States generally stands with Israel. I mean, it's too simplistic, but I do think she's right that in a strategic sense, Egypt's role has proven really critical. That if you had Morsi today, God forbid, in power, think of what the Sinai would look like, what Gaza would look like, what the threats against Israel would be.
Yeah, no question about that. We asked you earlier, I mentioned earlier about your comments on Israeli television, and one of the things that you were asked about was the efforts by certain people in the United States to influence the election in Israel. Are you getting the feeling that that in fact there's, I mean, we discussed this last week. I don't know what you've been able to discover there while you're there, but is there undue influence? Is there an unfair participation among American groups in the Israeli election at this point?
I do think that there are that it is destructive to democracy when you have people who are not, you know, affected by the results and who can make decisions just based on their own personal predilections or views and don't have to deal with the consequences of a vote. And that's why I think when people go into the voting booth, you know, they don't want to waste their vote. They want to think about it. And I don't believe that the impact of the foreign influences is perhaps determinant, but it is a factor. And it's true on all sides. This is not a partisan comment. It's something I've said for many years. I think it's a mistake for American Jews to they can express views. They can, you know, certainly wish for certain people, but to interfere in the process, I think it is a mistake, and I think when Israelis interfere in American political processes, it's a mistake.
All right. The question is, are you getting the feeling that it's really happening? And we understand you're philosophically against it. A lot of people are. But, you know, practically, on the ground, is the machination in place right now where there's great American influence on this election?
I wouldn't say that. I would say that, you know, the reports that people have made contributions, some are funding reports of the funding of, let's say, negative campaigns, as we described, and then in America, independent campaigns against a candidate. I do think that that has happened. I don't think, and I haven't been able to gauge that any indication that it is decisive. As I said, I think people are unsure how they want to vote, are examining all of this very carefully, and may not really be able to make a determination until they go in the booth and finally decide.
Right, yeah. Seems to be that type of election. All right, the speech. Last week you said 70% chance it'll take place. I'm referring, of course, to Bibi in front of the joint session of Congress. Whether it takes place or not, the speech itself I don't think is the real issue here. The issue is we can't get this out of the headlines. We can't get this controversy about how he was invited and why he was invited and whether he should have been invited and whether it's important for him to address Congress even if he's not welcome in Washington. You know, those who are saying that he has a moral obligation to give this speech. You know, forget about what, you know, how and what and who's being insulted and who's not. Some feel there's a moral obligation, Malcolm, for him to get up and give the speech vis-a-vis Iran in Washington.
That is true. There are people who recognize the importance of this issue of Iran and that the prime minister says his state and his country faces an existential threat. So does the West, I think. And that given the opportunity to speak to the most powerful legislature in the world, an invitation extended, the process is not irrelevant. I think we can't allow Israel to become a partisan issue. We can't allow it to be the U.S.-Israel special relationship to be undermined and congressmen and senators having to take sides. I hope that there will still be a resolution some kind. You know, there's a lot of thought being given to it. A lot of good people have called me with suggestions.
I am sure there's a lot of thought.
Every one of them.
Because if this does stay in the headlines, he's going to have to pull out because I believe that there's going to be a perception that it could lose in the election if he, quote-unquote, embarrasses the President of the United States.
I don't think it will. I don't think here you have that perception. And it's not debated in the same way. They're more interested in the gossip part of it, you know, who did it and right. Who was responsible. And how but as I said before, if it had been Clinton or George Bush II, I think the reaction might have been different because the attitudes towards them were different. President Obama's popularity, as shown in the polls, is not very high. They are concerned, and there should be concern, that the U.S.-Israel relationship not be damaged. And I think there's no reason here that it should. You can't let personal pique or egos or other things determine what happens on very vital issues which both countries need. And I think that the enemies of both are sitting back and laughing at this and enjoying it. And the friends of both countries are scratching their heads and said, what is going on? What does this mean? And I can tell you that I've had calls from leaders outside of Israel asking about it and sort of, you know, shaking their heads. And as you said, it's got to get out of the headlines. It's got to be resolved. Because people, even in America, there will be people who wanted to, you know, instigate against Israel will use this and are using it in talk shows and political statements, etc.
Finally, in Argentina, and we've discussed the, should we call it murder now? Should we call Nisman's demise a murder or not?
I think so, and I think the evidence largely points to it. There's nothing conclusive yet, but I certainly think that that is a fair assumption.
What's interesting is the reaction in Argentina. I assume it's not just members of the Jewish community who are taking to the streets demanding justice. Am I right?
No, there are others, many others. He was highly respected. His colleagues and others have been speaking out about it. But it's you know, the details are still very murky. What emerged this week that was really, I think, extremely significant was that in the garbage of, you know, at his apartment, they found a 26-page document that requested the arrest of Timmerman, the foreign minister.
Right.
And I think, and he had drafted an arrest warrant for President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, the president of Argentina, and he accused her of trying to shield Iranian officials from responsibility in the bombing of the Amia Center in 94. The fact that he had drafted these arrest warrants, supposedly these new revelations that came out, it shows the tension between them, and that day was the day when he was testify before the Argentinian Congress about these accusations. So it's another layer of suspicions added to the to what existed. There were demonstrations that people in Argentina generally do not believe it was a suicide, and then his successor denied that they found it, and later had to correct the record and saying she should have said they did find these documents.
Is there enough?
People are looking and saying, are we going to get a whitewash? Are we going to get Timmerman and Kirchner off the hook? Or are they going to just delay it till it's no longer relevant?
Well, the delay might work because I don't know if this level of anger or passion is going to, you know, stay the way it is in Argentina. And, you know, as time goes by, things tend to, you know, drift away. The question is, can there be enough passion maintained there for justice that would, you know, in fact, make a difference? And I guess that's what remains to be seen.
And this is a test of Argentina, and the international community has to come in, and Americans and others, to put pressure on them to take the steps necessary. Many voices, courageous voices inside Argentina, have spoken up about it. But many Jews, there have been threats, there have been demonstrations against the Jews, there have been assaults again in Buenos Aires and other places that seems to become more and more commonplace. And we see the subversion of justice. Look what happened with Chavez. He resigns.
Right.
And yet the investigation continues. They appoint somebody who came out of New York's court systems as a replacement. They didn't shelve it. They didn't say we're going to have to disregard everything that was done till now, because Chavez, it turns out, had worked as a consultant to the Palestinian Authority or to the PLO not long ago, not 10 years ago, but 2 or 3 years ago. And the you know, the shame and the sham of that investigation, which has no justification even under their rules, under international court rules, and I hope that the under the Human Rights Council rules. And I hope also that the ICC, International Criminal Court, which is going ahead with its investigation of Israel, will also be brought to heel. And there again, we need the United States to take a lead. We need Europeans. We need others to voice if they want to protect these institutions, if we want to show that those really guilty will be held to account.
You know, Malcolm, because of the reaction of Jordan, you mentioned the airstrikes against ISIS, and there's a headline in today's Jerusalem Post about ISIS. It says here, seen under strain in Syria, though far from collapse, which would indicate that they had a bad week, I guess. For those of us who like to see good defeat evil, is there hope here? Is there hope that the collective of countries, in fact, can defeat ISIS?
Could the ISIS be defeated? Yes. It takes America to stand up to those who are aiding and abetting them. It means that we can't send the wrong message in Iraq, where you have 50 new militias that have emerged, many of them taking their weapons from the United States. Michael Flynn, who was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, just retired. He said the members of the Badr Corps are responsible for killing many American soldiers, and they'll do it again if given a chance. You see that the Hezbollah training the Badr Brigade. So while American policy is to support integration of these militias, we're in fact helping to support the creation of groups that are integrating into the Shiite militias,
yeah,
which in turn sometimes support are identified with IS and with Al Qaeda. So, you know, there isn't the clarity of message. There has to be a unified front. Iran, one of the great experts on the Shiite militias, said, uses Iraq as a petri dish to grow new Shia jihadist groups. And when you see what is going on the ground, when you see the more obvious and blatant role that Iran directly and the IRGC, Iran Revolutionary Guard, play with Hezbollah in the Golan, along the Golan, in Lebanon, if we don't, and then of course we're going to see this in Gaza, right, and then increase the efforts in Sinai and Gaza. They graduate 15,000 young people from a one-week training course run by Hamas on terrorism. And where's the outcry? Where's the world that was so concerned about Israel defending itself and what was happening in Gaza saying that's not what we were speaking up for? And you see why Israel has to act in the way that it does, because look at the nature of the enemy that it faces. Many of the Arab countries are saying, no more. We're not going to tolerate it. That was what King Hussein's message. That's what Sisi's message. It's the message you're hearing more and more.
Let's hope we continue to establish leaders who are able to carry out that message. We need it so badly. Malcolm, enjoy Jerusalem, and we'll speak Bezrat Hashem next week.
God willing, next week from Vienna.
Vienna?
Vienna.
I better start preparing my...
We're going to do a Viennese waltz together.
There you go. I'm going to start preparing my trivia questions about Vienna all through the week. There he is. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.